Good morning and welcome to the Tuesday morning show on this rather chilly, almost wintry like November. Probably suitable weather for election day, wouldn't you say, Katie?
Yes, I mean almost wintry. I would say this is full-blown winter, Phil.
You know, nature is smiling upon us somehow, but we have a great morning show this morning. Katie Eglin-Cox is in the studio with us. We're going to be talking about Kiniksu Land Trust's housing initiatives, but since we've opened the topic of the weather, let's just delve into it a little bit further because it's always on everyone's minds. And although it's a day today that you might want to normally stay at home, if you have not voted, get out and vote. Find a safe way to do it. Allow yourself a little extra time. The roads were slick and filled with cars this morning. Beyond that, it's supposed to be sunny today with a high near freezing just below at 29 degrees. Tonight, the overnight low is a chilly 12 degrees Fahrenheit. I'd say bundle up, throw the extra dog or cat on, and you know, stoke a bit of wood on the fire.
Absolutely.
Tomorrow, sunny, a high of freezing, 32, a low again of 12. Thursday, back to 32. In the evening, back to 13. We're going to bounce back and forth between freezing and mid-low teens for the next several days with a little bit of increasing clouds, but no precipitation in the weather, so probably what you see on the ground is what you're going to get for the next several days. So plan your strategies accordingly. We're going to move right into the interview. Since we have Katie in the studio here with us, live, back live, it's nice to be doing this again.
It's so nice to be back, Phil. Yeah. It's nice to be here in the studio room with the skylight and the sunshine shining down on us.
Yes. For those who are first-time listeners and aren't familiar, Katie is the executive director of the Kiniksu Land Trust, referred to affectionately KLT by many here locally. We do have a lot of first-time listeners moving to the area, so give us a quick rundown on the history of Kiniksu Land Trust and the mission and the general scope of work.
Excellent. And the fun little thing to note is on Sunday, we actually celebrated our 20-year anniversary of Kiniksu Land Trust, which started 20 years ago as the Clark Fork Pondere Conservancy. And as most nonprofits start, Phil and I were just talking about that, about another nonprofit, started as a very small organization, very volunteer-heavy, and working on the conservation of and protecting lands along the that carried bull trout. And really as a initiative of Avista and the work to relicense the dams. So now, 20 years after that, the organization has grown robustly. We are the main conservation organization here serving Bonner County, Boundary County, and Sanders County, Montana. That means we work with private landowners who choose voluntarily to put their land in private conservation. And so we have over 4,000 acres of land owned by private citizens, although some special properties like Pine Street Woods, which you might have heard about, is owned by us, but most of the land owned by private citizens who chose to put their land in conservation. Along with that, as the program grew, so did our work within the community. We say we love to help solve community challenges, and one of those challenges was getting people out in nature. And we first started with a education, working with Lake Pondere School District and helping to get kids outside. And now, last year alone, we 2,240 visits by children out into nature with the help of Kiniksu Land Trust. So we're pretty proud of our education program, not only our in-school education, but our camp, which is a summer camp, Camp Kiniksu, where children spend 1 week really integrated into nature and outdoors. As well as that, like I said, we have public access properties, Pine Street Woods, which is well known by many people in the Sandpoint area. It's about 2 miles outside of the heart of Sandpoint. And that received in 2020 over 20,000 visits. It has over, approximately 8 miles of trails within Pine Street Woods, but it's larger, part of the larger Syringa Trail system, which includes Sherwood Forest and VTT, and that whole trail system, probably a contiguous 12 to 15 miles of trails that you could spend all day on and never cross another trail. But as well as that, if you're out for a Sunday drive, we have a beautiful property along the Montana-Idaho border. Just turn right in Clark Fork on the River Road, And it's absolutely right at the border. It's the Cabinet View Nature Area, which is another beautiful property, 80 acres. Very different than Pine Street Woods, but it has trails. It has a beautiful pond. And like I said, a really nice Sunday drive.
We have such an abundance of habitats here, and there are so many reasons to conserve them. The initial focus of the work on wetlands or areas associated with water is of great interest because it seems like where land meets water, that's always where certain magical things happen.
But absolutely. I often say that wetlands are the sidewalk for the animals.
And then, of course, to provide for the long-term sustainable community interest necessary for conservation, areas that are important for recreation or for simply getting folks out into nature are so vital.
Mm-hmm. There's a reason why we all live here. There's a reason why people have chosen to move here, or reason why people have stayed there through their whole lives and generations. And those are for those very reasons that we all make that choice, we need to work to make sure that we protect it so it is here not only for us but for future generations.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about your background. How did you come to Sandpoint? We talked about people moving here, and how did you come to find yourself in this line of work?
Very interesting. I often joke that I'm probably the only executive director of a land trust that came as an architect. So very interesting background. I grew up in Idaho. I grew up in Moscow, Idaho, in a little town called Elk City, Idaho, which not many people know about. But just look in the middle of the state, in the middle of wilderness, put your finger right there, and that's Elk City, 60 miles on a dead-end road. And then that gave me an amazing experience growing up in the heart of Idaho. I went to the University of Idaho. I ended up, interestingly, getting a degree in education. Education is near and dear to my family's heart. My mom was a principal in Elk City and a teacher in Moscow, as was my dad, but then he was in real estate. So I was very interested in, I was very interested as a small child in building. And so I ended up moving over to the Seattle area with my husband for a job for him, and ended up going, figuring out that my true passion was design and architecture. So I got a master's degree in architecture from the University of Washington and then practiced for about 15 years. And my practice was solely focused on, as much as I could direct it, focused on building community. How do you use the built environment to bring community together? And so as many projects as I could get that were focused in that direction, that's what I would do. After 10 years, we moved back here to Idaho. We were looking for the next possible way of getting back home. And we chose Sandpoint because of my husband's job actually carried him back here. He ran lumber companies, and one of the lumber companies was up in Naples, Idaho, that his company ran. And so we moved back here to Sandpoint, and I was working in architecture, working on community-focused projects, helping Evans Brothers, Panhandle Cone and Coffee, a medical center here, but in the same time, I volunteered with Kinnexu Land Trust to help them run their capital campaign for Pine Street Woods, which needed $2.1 million in private funds. And so I co-chaired that campaign with Jim Zuberbühler, our now board president, and really enjoyed getting to know the organization and seeing the work that they do that involves community. And when the campaign was over, the executive director at the time, Eric Grace, he chose to move down and take a position down in Boise, and the ED position came open. And to be honest, I didn't even think about it because I didn't have a conservation background. And then I sat down with one of the board members, and he said, take a look again. I think there's some stuff in there that might interest you. And I really took a look at the job description, and I saw that it was very focused on community. And I thought, well, this is an interesting segue in my life. Always focused on community, but focused on the built environment. What about focusing on the unbuilt and seeing how that brings community together? And so that's why I ended up taking the position as executive director, was really to see how we could use nature to bring community together. And I can honestly say that I feel the power of that work has amplified doing this work over building houses and building structures.
And that's been 4 years now?
It's been three in June, so about three and a half.
Okay,
pretty close, Phil.
Yeah. COVID has just warped our sense of time. It seems like yesterday in some ways, but I know it's been longer. So, yeah.
Exactly.
Now, I don't think he was ever involved in a land trust, but one of the icons in the wilderness movement and conservation and trails was a landscape architect, Benton McKay, a personal hero of mine. In fact, the whole concept for the Appalachian Trail, which he was the originator of, was introduced at a Society of American Landscape Architects in 1919. And he went on to hold positions in various administrations working on exactly the kind of things you're just talking about, the interface of landscape architecture and community.
And yeah. And I think it's really interesting because I think for all those kids listening out there who are considering architecture degrees or landscape architecture or, you know, planning degrees, it actually gives you a really interesting way of thinking about a problem and creating design solutions. And so a lot of times when we're talking about challenges that we're having in the community, then I come at that with a design, you know, can design thinking solve this problem? So there's lots of applications beyond just being a, as people will say, being a CAD monkey. There's lots of applications to use that kind of thinking to help solve a myriad of problems and be involved in a whole bunch of different occupations where it's really good to have that, and I would say probably out of the box creative mind working on challenges.
A lot of occupations and a lot of community challenges. Let's move directly into the main topic and we'll come back to some of the other things we want to chat about. But one of the pressing issues in our area, it's been identified by many, is a housing crisis on multiple levels, from affordable housing for those who are simply getting, you know, priced out of the market because wages aren't keeping up with the cost of living for housing, to simply finding workforce housing for middle-class jobs. It is a burgeoning crisis as prices for both purchase and rental go up.
Yes, absolutely. It's a huge problem in our community. It's a problem in communities like us all around the West. And so these are the types of things that when we're working at the land trust, we're really trying to, as I say, like, keep our ear to the ground with the challenges of our community and trying to figure out, do we have a part to play in this, in creating a solution to this challenge? And this was one of those that, you know, might not stand out for people when they think about Kinnexy Land Trust and they think about land conservation and they're like, why are you getting involved in housing? I don't get the connection there. And how it came about, I think a good thing to do is to just talk a little bit about how we as an organization, which includes the board of directors, because they have a huge part to play in the organization, how we came about and made this decision to, I would say, dip our toe into this challenge. And it was really, when we think about it, it was really back in right before 2020, we started working on our strategic plan. We're working on, you know, what we really want to focus on for the next 5-10 years. And within that work, at the same time, I would say we are experiencing some of the things that I know all of us locally were feeling. We were seeing, you know, when you look back at the statistics, it's sort of amazing. In 2019, our aggregate yearly household income was $44 million. And it was sort of that for, you know, for quite a while, looking, you know, 5 years beyond that back. In 2020, it jumped to $115 million. And so we were seeing the things like that, and then we were seeing a large influx of people moving in, and we were thinking about what that was going to do for land. As more people moved in, as we fragmented our landscape more, how does that impact the things that we as an organization are trying to take care of, which includes water quality, which includes food, helping to preserve our agriculture, our ranch lands, our forestry land, lands of cultural significance, those lands that are important to the Kalispell and the Kootenai tribe. What's happening as people are moving in, as our 20 acres are getting subdivided into 5 acres, as migration corridors are cut off? Well, what's happening is that's exactly what's happening. All those things that are important to us as a community are getting fragmented and are getting chopped up. And so we thought about, how do we, as an organization, though, we know that people are moving in, we need to balance this. We need to help find the balance between people and the land. And in order to do that, we need to make sure that there is that housing, that there's housing for people who live here and work here close in. Because the more that we, you know, push people out into the, and you can see it when you think about places like in down in South Idaho, when you think of Jackson Hole and you think of the impacts that they felt in the Teton Valley, we could say, oh well, you're going to go up north and you're going to buy 1 acre up north, or you're going to go south into Rathdrum, or you're going to live where you're commuting in 45 minutes. Well, there is a lot of impact in a community when you're telling people, no, the only place you can afford is 45 minutes away. You're causing wear on your roads, more bills on your roads, more bills for those people paying for gas. They're not investing, they're not grocery shopping in your own community. There's a lot of things that start breaking down when you don't have that housing close in. And so we made a concerted decision as an organization and as a board of directors at that point to move it into our strategic plan, that we didn't know what that would look like, but that we were going to work on that balance between land and people.
Mm-hmm. Those were some remarkable figures in there. And I want to just go back to one of them for a moment. Trying to remember the exact term you used, not combined household income, but.
Yeah, the aggregate yearly households grew.
Aggregate. Mm-hmm. That was a remarkable leap.
Yeah, remarkable.
Is it possible to break that down to where that's coming from?
Yeah. So this is that study that the Leland Group did for the city of Sandpoint, and they came in June 2022 and looked at sort of our housing. They did a housing study, and there were some really interesting facts and figures from there that I pulled, and that really helped us. Well, there's one thing within that report that was really interesting to me, given what we're working on now, but. So some other really fascinating things. Our growth has come from wealthy older newcomers, which obviously drives up the home value and forcing out that lower income earner. There, we have more people dying in our county than being born. So that tells you that all of the growth that we're experiencing is from in-migration. At the same time, in 2018, we can... average median home price, we all know, was between $300,000 and $400,000. Well, in 2022, that skyrocketed to $675,000 to $700,000. So what that means that in June 2022, the median asking price for a single-family home was 14.6 times higher than the median income could afford. So that median income is that income of our workforce. So a house for our workforce was 14.6 times higher than they can afford. Yeah.
Yeah. It opens up a question on so many levels about what's affordable, what's necessary, what is needed to do to close this gap. Because if the middle class and the working class are priced out, then you no longer have a sustainable community.
Exactly. Exactly. The community that we know and love and that we all live here for, moved here for, mm-hmm. That's what's not possible.
So take us back to the moment in time where you're engaging in looking through these studies commissioned for the city of Sandpoint. Mm-hmm. And the figures are for a countywide approach, which is mm-hmm. necessary as so many people work in the city, live outside the city limits. And Kinnickson Land Trust decided to engage. What were the next steps?
Yeah, so from that architecture background, right? I've seen the concept of community land trusts really be a concept that can work for communities like ours. The Metau Valley, which some of us know from Nordic skiing, they have an amazing community land trust. So we started thinking about how could our community solve this problem? How could we keep people living close into the community? And I reached out to an individual as we began thinking about this and thinking about do we take our, you know, take a step into the water here. The first thing we started doing is reaching out to all of those organizations here and regionally to see what they were doing in terms of housing. And so that looks like, you know, Habitat for Humanity North Idaho. There's a group going doing housing work down in Coeur d'Alene, seeing, like, is there a way to partner? Of course, there's also Bonner County Housing Agency, who we work pretty closely with, and looking at what is their capacity and what are they working on. And there's a difference here. One of the things you just said was talking about affordable housing versus workforce housing. The easiest way to think about it is affordable housing is a housing that helps to meet the housing needs of those that earn 60% or under the average median income. Workforce housing looks at 60% to about 120% of the average median income. So we had lots of organizations in this region working on affordable housing, which is absolutely desperately needed. We didn't have anybody really working on this workforce housing issue in our region, nor really anybody working on it yet, although they're trying down in the Coeur d'Alene region. And so first I wanted to identify, is there just somebody that we can partner with and we can support as an organization? Because that's ideally what we like to do, is partner and support and lift up other organizations. But seeing that there wasn't any, then we started exploring this idea of a community land trust. Because the one thing that, you know, we have in our quiver that we know how to do is we know how to work with land. We know how to work on titles because we do this with our conservation easements. We know how to work with landowners. We know how to hold land, Pine Street Woods being a good example. We know how to be the caretaker of land. And so this idea of a community land trust was very interesting to our organization as a whole. And so we started exploring the community land trust model and does it fit here for this region. And I reached out. One of the first reach outs I did was to an interesting individual, Michael Brown, who's with Burlington Associates, which is over in Burlington, Vermont, but he was located in Bozeman, Montana. And Michael and I had a great, great first initial visits about the community land trust model, if Sandpoint was the right place, what we were experiencing. And we ended up, through the help of Project 7B and other organizations, we ended up bringing Michael Brown here to have a community forum about community land trusts and to really help our community learn what a community land trust is and if it's the right solution for the challenges that we're facing today.
So tell us a little bit about that forum. That was back in June, as I recall.
That was back in June, yep. That was back in June, and we probably had about 70 people attend that forum, so a pretty huge interest from our community. And it was a great forum where not only did we hear from Michael and hear about the community land trust model, which I will say, I'll sort of stop right now so I can explain to the listeners, the community land trust model is a model where an organization, nonprofit organization in this case, would own the land, and then the land on the land is built, you build the houses. And the idea is that then the people in the community are able to buy that house, but that house price is lower because the land value has been taken out of it. And they buy that house, but they do not buy the land. The land is held in a 99-year lease, which the lease stays with the house, and then if the house is sold, the 99-year lease starts again. So it's a way to bring a housing type to our community that meets that average median income, that workforce housing type. Now, in this case, in our case, in our county, the cost of building and our AMI, that would make it that we would also need to add additional subsidies. Michael introduced a project that's over in Bozeman called Bridger View, which was really interesting to us because that Bridger View is building, they're building a set of houses, 72 houses, 36 of which are community land trust houses, 36 that look the exact same, that are houses that will sell at market rate. And so they're going to try to get the most money they can for those houses, and then they use the subsidy from those sales in order to subsidize the community land trust houses. So that was a very interesting model because the one thing we really understood is that if we're going to do this, we need to do it And if we're going to do this and have a large impact, which is what our community needs, we need to build a good base of houses.
So in this particular situation, the Bridger example, mm-hmm. those 36 houses that are being sold, traditionally, the land title goes along with them. So
exactly.
Michael, who's the developer, representing the developer, purchases a large tract of land, basically cuts it in half. Half of it goes for a traditional development home sale, and the other half is retained for the community land trust approach.
Correct, but it's a little different in that they're weaving it together. So it's not that, like, everybody on this side of the road has traditional house, you know, bought their houses. Everybody on this side of the road are CLT. They're really integrating it, which is a beautiful concept, because I don't know if you saw the recent friending study. It was put out by the New York Times. It talks about how do we lift children out of poverty, or how do we lift children from poverty into better situations? And the friending study showed that if we can get more people, and really the biggest impact is living across socioeconomic lines in the same space, in the same neighborhoods, that's how we truly can lift children out of a poverty situation. And so I think the power of that model really comes from people from all different backgrounds being able to live together in a community setting.
That's very interesting. And, you know, without getting too wonky into the details, and I'm not a realtor, but I could project that then, say, 10 years time, 15, 20 years time, when some of those houses are coming for sale, half of them are valued very differently than the other half in terms of looking at comparable sales figures.
Yeah, that's true. You can get down into the real estate, but the way that the community land trust housing works is really that is an internal model of sales. And so it's truly that somebody, you get on a wait list. And then when a house with the CLT comes open, then the next person from the wait list moves on. So they're looked at, you know, very differently.
Different,
but the goal is really to make that whole community feel very, very much the same. And that really also lifts the housing type for the CLT as well, because you're going to be trying to get the most money possible for the houses that you build for market rate.
Right.
So you can't. And, you know, you have to build them all to the same specs.
So what was the feedback in June on the concept?
The feedback was, we're interested. We think this could help. And it was there was a huge amount of interest from our community. There was part of the forum that we really sat down in groups, and we brainstormed some of the challenges that we felt were out there. And then some of the things that we felt would really work well for the community. And so Kinnexu Land Trust took that feedback back to our organization, sort of looked through all those things that we thought were going to be challenges, and started working on those as we were simultaneously working on what this would look like to truly take on this type of initiative within the organization. So that work was being done at the board level. And and started thinking about a first potential project.
So let's take a short music break, and then we'll come back and find out how the results have borne fruit, as they say. If you're just tuning in, this is the KRFY Morning Show Tuesday edition right here at 88.5 FM. I'm Phil Huff, your host, and with me this morning is Katie Eglin Cox from the Kinnexu Land Trust. We're talking about the housing situation in Bonner County and some of the opportunities for things that can be done about it. For the moment, we're going to listen to Carla Bonoff and her version of Home, and then we'll come back and hear more from Katie about what direction this is going in. Carla Bonoff, Home, which we are talking about today. Welcome back to KRFY, the morning show, with your host, Phil Hoff, and our guest today, Katie Eglin Cox from Kinnexu Land Trust, and we're talking about the local challenges with both affordable and workplace housing and some of the potential solutions. Katie, bring us back with a little bit more of the Leland study that came out after the June meeting and where we go from there.
Yeah, so it was really interesting, Phil. So we had done the community forum, and we as an organization decided, okay, you know, I think there's enough interest here that we should think about this a little bit more. But then right after that, the Leland study came out, and one of the most interesting things, I told you a bunch of the statistics that came out of it that really sort of highlighted the issue that we were facing locally. But one of the most interesting things was that they highlighted three solutions. And as they said, it was to get the most gains in new units at or near affordable levels. And the third solution that they stated was a community land trust. And so when I read that and shared it with our board, we said we are on the right track. We should continue to pursue this. So that I thought that that was a really, it was really interesting, just that this whole study, after looking at our entire community, would come up with that solution too. It gave us the boost we needed to step
in. It confirms it's the right direction.
Yes.
June seems like so long ago, especially with the snowy streets today, but, you know, really not all that long ago. And yet there's been some good progress made towards bringing this into reality. Tell us a little more.
Yeah, we've been working pretty, I would say, pretty fast pace on it. We put together an amazing planning group that was really designed to help the land trust in all of the areas where we don't have expertise, and making sure that we have a team on board that is helping us along the way. It included planning professionals, construction professionals, design professionals, project manager, interested individuals from our community. So it was a robust group of about 7 or 8 individuals that could sit down at the table and help us, and have helped us all along this process to make sure that what we're doing will ultimately end up being the successful model that we're looking at trying to create for our community. So early on, we we were given a potential project site. And I will say, I'm going to say this out there to Radioland, that ideally, of course, one of the best ways to accomplish this and make it a true success is if we were to receive a donation of land. And a donation of land within, again, the city core, this community, our community core, where, because in order to make a community land trust work, you have to make sure that you have water and you have sewer services. So it really has to be in this area that has these services already available. It doesn't make sense, obviously, especially for who our organization is, to take 20 acres 10 miles out of town, put septic systems on them all and drill for water. That's not the model here. The model is really making sure that the people that are living in community land trust housing are living in the community, and are able to ideally walk to their jobs or, you know, bike to their jobs easily. So in looking for land, we did identify a piece of property in Ponderay that fit most all of the things that we were looking for in terms of the ability to have high impact and build 40 or more houses. So that included, it was 5 acres of land that had water or sewer available. And then we also, as an organization, wanted to look at, you know, can we enhance a property through the work that we're going to do and the housing that we're going to do. So the piece of property that we found, what will eventually be connected to the Bay Trail, as the Bay Trail comes and goes under the train tunnel under the train in Ponderay, and then shoots up towards the Field of Dreams. We found a piece of property along that. And so we wanted to make sure it was on the trail, but then it also is on an amazing little creek that has been completely forgotten over time and would be, I will just speak for the creek and say it would love to be restored with this project. There are challenges, though, with this project. Currently, it is zoned industrial. Now, we could argue that when the railroad was the boundary of Ponderay and the highway was the boundary of Ponderay, that it made sense that this was industrial, and it might, for planning and zoning and city council, remain important that this stays industrial. But as that bridge is, in a way, that railroad that has been a wall in Ponderay comes down because there's access now to the shoreline, it might make sense to rethink how Ponderay situates itself, and that being a back door to the lake now becomes a front door to the lake. So we do have some challenges. This might not be it might not be the piece of land, because we might not be able to get through that barrier that will be the, you know, will be in the hands of the decision makers at the city council. So if it's not that piece of land, hopefully there's another piece out there that where we can create this project and create this opportunity to keep our workforce housed.
So the next steps are planning and zoning change?
The next step would be planning and zoning change. We've already actually sat down with planning and zoning. I will say that the application at planning and zoning was denied, but it does go forward to city council. So we have an attempt to try again at city council. We have some other ideas of other things that might work. If it doesn't work at city council, we, you know, this is just all part of the process.
Mm-hmm. So one takeaway for the listeners is if you have 5 acres or more, especially within the city core, Pendray, Sandpoint, Dover, Kootenai, contact KLT.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Because that also gifts of land can, you know, there's lots of tax advantage to that as well. So.
Well, we hope that things go forward well. Are there anything listeners can be doing besides considering a donation of land?
I think that if you're really interested in this conversation, we want to know about it, and we're trying to really keep information coming out as we're going through this process for those interested. So if you're really interested, sign up. Go to our website, kinixu.org, and sign up to receive the... Let us know that you're interested in the housing issue and sign up to receive our mailings and just keep abreast of the work that we're doing. And I love to talk to anybody about this or anything that Kinixu Land Trust is doing. So if you have more questions, if you have concerns, give me a call, come into the office, sit down. You know, recently it was awesome. We had somebody come into the office who owns land up in the Selly Valley, who's interested in putting his land in conservation. Just so happens as we started talking that he helps with the community land trust over on the Washington Peninsula. So it's amazing the resources that I think live in this community that sometimes we don't know about. So if you have that resource and that knowledge, please come and share it with us.
Very nice. Well, we have a few moments to turn to other upcoming events, and I know a lot of folks would like to hear, especially with these recent sightings of snow. What's happening with the Save the Sled Hill campaign?
Oh my goodness, it's so hard with snow falling not to actually own the hill yet. We definitely did get some inquiries on our first snow day if people could sled, and unfortunately, until we own it or potentially do special gatherings, which we'll need to get permits for, we can't open the sled hill because, as the community knows hopefully by now, we don't own it. Friends of Kinixu Land Trust own it, and we need to raise that remainder money. So it's $2.1 million that we're raising for the purchase of the sled hill, and we only have $740,000 left to go. And so a big chunk has been raised, but we have to make it to that finish line in order to take those sleds up to the top and sled down. So we're working on it. We have neighborhood campaigns, and I would encourage everybody to either get involved or captain a neighborhood campaign. And what that looks like is just gathering people along your street, people with, you know, within your block, and really encouraging them to give to the sled hill. We really see this as a community-wide effort. So if we're going to make this work, it's going to be our whole community that comes together. Host a gathering, host a sled night, and have us come and speak to you. Have us come and tell you what we're going to do there, the vision of the sled hill, and we want to participate in these community gatherings, and we want to help get them going. So if you want to be a captain, give me a call. And if you want to gather your neighborhood and we can help in some way, let us know.
Wonderful. And there are a few other upcoming events for Kinixu Land Trust. Let's talk about those.
Yeah, Thursday night, this Thursday, November 10th.
Get plowed.
Get plowed for Pine Street Woods. Yeah. So this is our annual fundraiser to raise the money for the plowing costs to plow our road up to the top. And so that we can make sure that we can get those 850 students out there on Nordic skis, which the Sandpoint Nordic Club did last year. They got all of these school children out learning to cross-country ski. It also allows you access not only to the ski trails, but the bike trail. So plowing that road is essential, and it's depending on the winter, and this looks like it might be a good one. It's between $7,000 and $8,000 in cost. So this event Thursday night, it's going to be, last year it was, we packed Utara so full that we decided we needed to spill out into the street this year. So we have, it's a block party. We're closing Cedar Street from 2nd to 3rd, and we're bringing the party into the street. So we have iCarts is hosting, IPA is hosting, McDuff's is hosting, and Matchwood is bringing their little new car down. You got to come down to see the new little delivery vehicle from Matchwood. It's pretty darn cute. So we have all of those four organizations, and they're benefiting the Pondere Peddler, Sandpoint Nordic Club, and Kinnick'su Land Trust, who all make sure that there's active activities in the wintertime up at Pine Street Woods. So it'll be a fun night. It's from 6 o'clock, which is when we'll throw the barricades for the city streets, 6 o'clock to 9 o'clock. So dress very warm. We will have fires down there, but dress really warm because it's going to be super cold. But you know what? With cold brings snow. With snow brings fun up at Pine Street Woods.
Yeah, good advice with the National Weather Service forecast of, I think, 13 degrees for the night.
Yeah.
In streets that are icy, get some yak tracks or traction devices for your shoes. And while you want to get plowed, make sure someone else is driving home.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, Katie, as always, it's been wonderful. Any final thoughts before we close out this segment with a little music?
I think the final thought is it's towards the end of the year. There's 140 amazing nonprofits that are throughout our region. And at the end of the year giving is critical to keep those nonprofits working on the things that they are passionate about and you are passionate about. So I would encourage you to think about your donations towards the end of the year and making sure that you leave a little for each of those organizations and for their operations, because it takes a lot to make all of these organizations run, and we have so many that are such a value to our community. So
always a good reminder, and we're entering that time of year with Giving Tuesday right after Thanksgiving and the end of the year, really philanthropic season, which so many of those nonprofits are dependent on, and we do have a thriving nonprofit community. We interview many of them here on the radio station. Each listener may have their favorites. We'd ask you to remember that KRFY is community radio and supported by listeners like you. And you'll be hearing more about that in the coming weeks, which you always do. But
exactly. And we can't forget to say, go vote.
Yes, go
the
vote.
The most important thing for you to do today, go vote.
Go vote. That's a good note to close out this segment on. Thank you, Katie, for your time. And if anyone listened to only part of this and wants to hear the entire interview, you can download a podcast, probably starting sometime later this afternoon or tomorrow, right here at krfy.org. Thank you, Katie.
Thank you, Phil.
We're going to turn to a little Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, and then I'm going to come back with some upcoming events.